This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It can happen at the most inopportune time. You're in the middle of an important project and you start to daydream. But is this kind of mental detour a bad thing? Today, we're going to learn more about daydreaming and what the research shows. Joining me now are University of Cincinnati adjunct professor Rana Schatz. Welcome, Rana.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Great to have you. And Cincinnati Children's Professor Stephen Becker. Thanks for being here, Stephen.
Of course. Thank you, Lucy.
UC and Cincinnati Children's are financial supporters of Cincinnati Public Radio. Rana, let's start with you. What is quiet wakefulness or daydreaming? How do you really define that?
Well, it's a state of mind wandering. It actually comes from the activity of a particular brain network called the default network. It's called default because about 60% of our life we're in that network, as compared to another network which is more activity directed, like focused. And it's an interesting network when you kind of look at its connectivity. It is wired to all our senses, so it has a purpose of guarding us. And in fact, the word awareness, which is the activity of this, contains that word where, means on guard. It's on guard in our environment, and it is helping us to not just process information coming from our senses, but to make sense of it. So it is designed both for the moment, what's happening to us and how relevant is it to us, as well as some work during sleep as well in terms of memory.
So what's happening in our brain when we daydream, and are there ways that can be useful, that whole process?
Yes. So research has now sort of elucidated the fact that there is this crosstalk of newly stimulated neurons with the memory center, the hippocampus. We see little blips that are really like signals, a call and response kind of signals between newly stimulated areas of the brain for a particular set of incoming information, and beginning to make it a permanent record. So it's designed to help us both make a record of it and also distinguish it from other things that may be less relevant to us.
Oh, fascinating. Stephen, you recently completed a study with children, I believe between the ages of 8 and 12, mm-hmm. who daydream. You were specifically studying what's called cognitive disengagement syndrome. Can you explain what that is to us?
Absolutely. And so one of the things I really love about what Rana was just saying are some of the positive attributes of daydreaming. Some of my research has looked at the other side. So we know that there are some individuals, I specifically focus at children's, obviously on children and adolescents, who really we consider excessive daydreaming. So these are kids who really have a hard time letting go of their daydreams, even when they're engaging, or we might want them to be engaging in peer relationships or interacting socially or engaging in their classroom. So these kids might daydream, they might look like they're really staring off into space. And so we've done a lot of work, research over the past decade here in Cincinnati, as well as some colleagues around the world, trying to better understand the specific subgroup of children.
Hmm. We are talking about daydreaming and when it can be helpful and when it can be harmful. Do you have questions or comments about daydreaming and maybe what it's meant for you or your children? Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. So, Stephen, what did you find in your study?
So in one of the studies we conducted, we actually went into recess that kids had at their schools to actually look for the first time of how these children engage in the classroom. And so these were partner schools in Ohio as well as Northern Kentucky. And we had children who had elevations in this set of symptoms referred to as cognitive disengagement syndrome or CDS. And then we also found sex and grade matched comparison children without this set of symptoms. We had individuals who hadn't seen these children before. We went out and we actually went to their recesses, which if you've been to an elementary recess is a wild experience to try to follow them around. encode their behaviors every few seconds in terms of what they're doing, whether or not they're interacting with adults on the playground, whether or not they're engaged with kids, whether or not they're engaged in parallel play, so maybe near a kid, another child, but not directly engaging, or if they're really spending more time alone. And one of the clearest findings, and the first finding so far in the literature to date of actual direct observations of these children's peer environments, we found that those children who really have those excessive daydreaming scores were significantly more likely to be either alone during recess or to be in parallel play, so not directly engaging socially with others around them. These were a few recess periods, but when we start to think about what those social interactions mean, when you add them up across a school year or across development, it can become quite substantial.
So what does that tell you about these kids, that syndrome? What did you take away from that?
It's really led us to think a lot more about how we might want to structure environments for these children to optimize their success. So we know that recess, like some classroom environments, can be really chaotic. There can be a lot going on, and so it can be pretty overwhelming for some of these kids. So perhaps smaller groups or dyadic friendships might be something that we can foster. A lot of my research focuses on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, where we also don't think really about social skills training as particularly evidence-based for children with ADHD. But if children with this set of symptoms could really benefit from learning general social skills, perspective taking, making eye contact, how do you have a reciprocal conversation, those sorts of things, that might really help them to be less overwhelmed and to engage in their peer relationships.
And when you talk about dyadic friendships, what do you mean by that? Just smaller groups, one-on-one? What are you talking about there? Okay. Super. Does CDS, this cognitive disengagement syndrome, is that ever misdiagnosed as ADHD?
We think so. And to be perfectly clear, CDS is not itself a recognized disorder or diagnosis. Right now, it's a research term for this syndrome to understand what these symptoms are, but it's not a recognized mental health condition. It's not a diagnosis that someone could be given at this point in time. We do think that there are probably 25 to 50% of children with ADHD who have co-occurring symptoms in this domain as well. So we're doing some work now to try to understand what that might mean in terms of really understanding their profile of both strengths as well as difficulties to then lead us to thinking about then how might we think about whether our existing interventions work or they need to be modified or if we need to build new interventions from the ground up specifically for this group of children.
Hmm. Rana, there was a recent study in mice conducted by researchers at Harvard University that found a potential link between daydreaming and neuroplasticity. First, tell us what neuroplasticity is.
Neuroplasticity is the ability of the brain to be resilient in the face of a threat or an injury. And it basically, in terms of how we think about the brain as a series of networks, is finding other pathways. When one highway from A to B is blocked, let's have kind of a detour. And it is also building access linkages so that if we lose a few, we still have enough remaining for us to maintain function.
So building a detour yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah. Why is that so important?
As much as we don't like to think about it, as we get older, the genetic machinery and the proteins that help us maintain our bodies change. And instead of being very robust and rather automatic in terms of helping our brains remain healthy, we have to be much more deliberate. And there is a bias towards things breaking down as opposed to growing brain.
Mm-hmm. Is there this potential connection that these Harvard researchers found with mice and neuroplasticity? What is that connection between daydreaming and neuroplasticity? How did that seem to help in mice? How did they figure out that it seemed to help in mice? You can't ask the mouse, what are you thinking about?
Exactly. So what they were able to do is view a series of neurons that were stimulated with a series of visuals, and that they saw that there was a population of nerves that seemed to be not just stimulated at the beginning, but continue to remain as a stimulus group, and that this seemed to linger over time, a sense that a memory was being made, and it didn't go through the usual nighttime machinery.
Kind of like when you're doing your flashcards, when you're trying to remember all the capitals of the 50 states or quiz your kid or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah. Stephen, how is there any way that that can apply to the work you're doing? I mean, I guess excessive daydreaming in young children can be a problem with, as you said, forging these personal relationships, focusing during class, but can it also be kind of a superpower? Are they making these amazing, you know, pathways in their brains and kind of doing this mental work that maybe other people aren't?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And so we have some preliminary data that suggests that these kids might really benefit in some ways. And when we've interviewed families and we've talked with dozens of families related to this, they talk about the challenges their kids have, but they certainly also talk about my kid is so creative or they're really drawn to the arts. So our goal is really not to take away by any way, shape, or form daydreaming, but how do we think about being able to manage it in a way in context and settings where it is maybe more helpful compared to other settings where it's maybe a little bit more detrimental, like during the classroom or things like that.
Yeah, to be able to kind of almost control when
exactly.
you're doing it and when you're not, so you can focus that superpower
exactly.
when you need it. Okay. Well, stay with us. We'll be back after a quick break to continue our conversation. And later in the program, we're going to talk about the science of dreams and what they can mean for our waking lives. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our conversation about daydreaming and what it means for our brains. My guests are University of Cincinnati Adjunct Professor Rana Schatz and Cincinnati Children's Professor Stephen Becker. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Stephen, before the break, you were talking about this research that you've done with children at recess and, you know, you and all the people who did that, God love you, because that had to have been challenging. But we got an email from Barbara. She emails, I was wondering about the connection between daydreaming and ADHD, also the connection between the attention that the researcher was talking about. I guess attention span maybe is what Barbara's talking about. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Is there a connection? You said that these two things can occur in children at the same time, but does there seem to be a connection between daydreaming and ADHD?
Absolutely. So we know that one of the cardinal features of ADHD is difficulties with regulating attention or inattention. And so we know that the set of symptoms related to significant daydreaming and other inattentive sustained attention difficulties are very strongly associated. So they're not the same thing. And there's dozens now of empirical studies that show that they are separate and that this is not the same thing as ADHD, but they are closely related. And so that's where it comes down to the fact that 25 to 50% of children with ADHD might also show these other types of behaviors.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's part of why it can be misdiagnosed maybe as a child who has this CDS might be misdiagnosed with ADHD. Is that part of the problem there?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, also before the break, we were talking about this study that Harvard researchers did with mice. You know, I know a lot of research starts with mice when you do a study. What can that tell you? It's a big leap to go from mice to people, obviously. But Rana, what are the takeaways we can get from that?
Well, I think it's heartening. We know that this network that is involved in this daydreaming is one that is very vulnerable to breaking down with a disease we call Alzheimer's disease. And our understanding now is that this is not an inevitability. We certainly have genetic risk factors, but the kinds of activities that we engage in through a lifetime can create through neuroplasticity and this excess connectivity to preventing this condition, or at least even in the presence of pathology, allow us to continue functioning. So it is heartening, the idea, and we've known this for a long time, that engaging all the senses helps to, it's the portal to memory, okay? It's the way we have a record to make that underlies memory. So it's to say that this kind of quiet reflection, and not just working at trying to make memory, is something that's strengthening the network. We know this. It's the same thing in terms of sleep, that we need time for the brain not to be doing the actual work of guarding us in the environment, but time, close the office door, all the memories on the table, I need time to sort it and make sense of it. So it's the same thing during the day. It's saying that in the rush of things that are happening to us, we really need during that daytime to allow our brains to process this information to make it useful.
That's so fascinating to me. So is that quiet reflection very different for that brain health than, say, telling a story? Because I know when people are starting to exhibit early disease, early Alzheimer's, oftentimes they can remember things from the distant past. And so it's very tempting to engage, a relative or a loved one to say, tell me about that time this happened, this story you've told me before. Is that more work or does that help lead to daydreaming? I mean, how are those things connected in some way?
The way that memory is organized in the brain is, I always think of it like a diary, a personal diary. It's chronological. And the idea is information that we have put into this diary, it's very idiosyncratic, is also through a lifetime connected with all other kinds of information. So the oldest information is what we call crystallized and is more physically resistant to breaking down. So in the early disease, it's kind of like information's being put down in disappearing ink. It's there, but it doesn't stay anymore. That machinery is gone, but the rest is there. However, over time, even the binding for those memories in our journal are breaking down. But initially, the access, that reference we have to our lifetime, is still there. And that's the reason for that storytelling. It's a way they can access old memories. But there is also, I think this research is telling us, if we put people in more enriched environments, where there's we correct their hearing, their vision, we make sure they're in not necessarily visually complex, but
stimulating
environments, that this might help the machinery and help at least make some inroads for functioning. Doesn't take away disease. And there is good evidence that particular kinds of activities, ones that are novel, new, really gain the attention of our default network because it's on guard, and things that are sensory in nature. So it's saying that maybe providing these enriched environments and giving people quiet contemplation could help with memory.
Ah, fascinating. Stephen, I want to talk about your work again. Are children, do you think, more likely to daydream than adults? Are they better at it?
That's a great question. So I think daydreaming is such a complex word. And I think Rona spoke when we first started talking about mind wandering. And we know that kids and adults mind wander all of the time. Certainly all of us listening to the show or being on the show have all mind wandered at certain times, even as we've been talking. I think the research has also started to shift, importantly so, in not just thinking globally about mind wandering, but also the valence and the types of mind wandering. So it matters if you're thinking more about the past and maybe something that didn't go so well versus thinking about something positive in the future, like planning a vacation, or if you're thinking about yourself versus if you're thinking about other people. And so I think, I don't know the data specifically about rates being different compared to children and adults, but certainly I think there's something to be said about the content in which someone daydreams might foster some of that neuroplasticity or might foster some of those more negative mood or depressive symptoms or things along those lines as well.
And it sounds like, if I'm understanding your research correctly, when it comes to cognitive disengagement syndrome, does that really go beyond kind of the occasional daydreaming? That's more than just kind of looking out the window and seeing a bird and thinking, oh, a bird, you know, and that sort of thing. It's something that's disruptive. Can you talk about that distinction?
Absolutely. And that's where the term comes from. It's the cognitive disengagement that really feels a little bit outside of one's control. So harder to pull oneself back into a conversation or back realizing that your mind has drifted and I should probably switch back to listening to my teacher. So really we consider it excessive. And there are other behaviors that go along with it in terms of staring or losing one's train of thought or just feeling really slowed down.
Mm-hmm. Can CDS be treated, this cognitive disengagement syndrome? And if so, how?
We are just starting work related to that very important question. So we know that sleep really matters in terms of cognitive function and alertness. And so we do know that healthy sleep and just healthy bodily healthy habits are going to be really important, not only for ADHD-related symptoms, but also for the CDS symptoms specifically. We've done a pilot trial, so preliminary findings that show promise for mindfulness training. So to your comment earlier, Lucy, about is it really not getting rid of the daydreams, but really being able to control them, that's where I think mindfulness-based interventions could have a place. And we have some promising effects there that we hope to follow up in a larger trial in the future.
Ronna, you were shaking your head vigorously when Stephen was talking about sleep. It sounds like that's important for all of us, right?
Oh, it's super important. And in fact, the same two things you were talking about in children are things that we really see as directly connected to the risk of Alzheimer's mm-hmm. disease. Also, your comment about emotional valence, both these things have relevance to late life cognitive health. So sleep is both a time for consolidation of memory and processing, but it also helps to eliminate toxins that build up during the day. And that's more important as we get older, when our brains are subject to more inflammatory processes and build up these toxins. And then the positive valence aspect of this is extremely important. And I think so much of medicine has been on negative emotions and mitigating those. They're associated with dis-ease, very literally. But what we have learned is promotion of positive emotions directly help memory and supercharge it. And some of this is work that we're very interested in terms of awe and how that might help promote a cognitive reserve.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about what's next in both of these realms. Ronna, starting with you, what do you want to see coming next when it comes to research as it relates to daydreaming? I'm thinking you're more interested probably in the adult side of things and what the implications are for brain health and Alzheimer's. What kind of research do you want to see come next?
Well, I do want to say it really does start in childhood. So all the things that you're doing with children are extremely important for adults. We know that's when brain networks are fully formed and develop very robust kind of structures. But what we really want to know is more specifically, what are the activities to engage our brain that directly are going to improve memory? I think people are very focused on games and computer interface types of activities. And what we really want to know is, how is day-to-day mindfulness, day-to-day daydreaming, the promotion of positive emotions, including awe and humor, how are those actually helping memory? It's a different focus than mitigating negative emotions.
Interesting. What about you, Stephen? What's next with your research when it comes to children and kind of helping them regulate in a way that channels their superpowers mm-hmm. for good and not in a way that harms their studies and other relationships?
Yeah, in addition to treatment studies, which we desperately need, two important areas for research that we're currently working on come to mind. The first being really taking a more balanced perspective to understanding these children and their whole selves. So we've currently are collecting data to look at creativity and positive attributes to have a more balanced lens to some of the challenges that these youth might also encounter. And we also know some of the challenges that they encounter, but we don't know the why behind these difficulties. So we're also doing a couple of longitudinal studies where we're following children as well as adolescents to try to not only see how these symptoms might change across development, but also what are the different processes or developmental aspects that might contribute to both positive or less positive outcomes for these children.
Well, we will look forward to talking with you more in the future about all that. I've been talking with University of Cincinnati adjunct professor Rana Schatz and Cincinnati Children's professor Stephen Becker. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll talk about the science of dreams and what they can mean for our waking lives. This is Cincinnati Edition.